begin this morning with a story that you might wonder how it matches up. This probably is not the first time that you're going to wonder how a story of mine matches up. This is a story about a toothpaste factory. A toothpaste factory had a big problem. They sometimes shipped empty boxes without the tube of toothpaste inside. Now, this made their retail suppliers wonder about the quality of the whole product if they couldn't even get the toothpaste tubes into the boxes. So, understanding how important this relationship with the suppliers was, the CEO of the company assembled his top people. And they decided to hire an external engineering company to solve their empty boxes problem. And the project followed the usual process: budget, project sponsor, third party selected to do the research. 6 months and $8 million later, they had a fantastic solution. On time, on budget, and high quality. Everyone on the project was pleased. Here's how they solved the problem. They used a high-tech precision scale that would sound a bell and flash lights whenever a toothpaste box weighed less than it should. In other words, when it was empty. The line would stop when this empty box came across that scale, and someone would walk over, remove the empty box, and then press another button to restart the whole assembly line. As a result of this new monitoring process, no empty boxes were being shipped out of the factory. With no more customer complaints, the CEO felt that the $8 million was well spent. And he wanted to do some analytics on this project in case he wanted to follow that same kind of process in the future. And he looked at his statistics and he discovered that the number of empty boxes picked up by this scale in the first week was consistent with all their projections, about 12 boxes a day that were empty. Then he noticed that in the next 2 weeks, in week two and week three, there were zero empty boxes. He couldn't figure that out because they hadn't addressed this part of the problem, so he went to put eyes on it himself. He traveled down to the factory. He viewed the part of the line where the precision scale was installed. And he saw, just in front of the new $8 million solution, he saw a $20 desk fan blowing the empty boxes off the assembly belt. Well, he asked the line supervisor, "What is that?" And the line supervisor said, "Oh, Bert, the guy from maintenance, put it there because he was tired of having to get up and walk over every time the buzzer buzzed and the alarm lights flashed." So here's my question. What did the CEO do next? Embarrassed by Bert's simple fix for the problem, did he fire Bert and the supervisor and anyone who might have witnessed the fan solution? Had he invested so much of the company's financial and personnel resources that he just had to use the multi-million dollar super sensitive scale? Did he maybe even double down and have the project team create another device that would mechanically remove the empty boxes that the scale identified? Maybe some kind of trap door or vacuum tube that would zap those empty boxes right up. before? Did the CEO take a completely different approach? Did he promote the supervisor and call in the guy from maintenance to say, hey, let's walk around and look at everything, and you tell me where we've got opportunities for doing things better than we are doing them now? And what if, you remember that all our Lenten sermons have begun with what if, right? What if the church was the toothpaste factory and the religious establishment was the CEO and the maintenance people were the Bishop Spongs and the Rachel Held Evans and the Troy Perrys? Would the religious establishment be able, in spite of all they have invested in their rights and their rules and their refusals to let anything change, would they be able to accept a new word? Even welcome it? Well, most have not so far. But that doesn't mean that we should stop inviting them to change, even when warranted demanding that they change. Friends, we've asked some provocative questions during this Lent. What if we don't need saving? For God so loved the world that God gave God's only Son so that everyone who believes in him may not perish but have eternal life. Indeed, God did not send the Son into the world in order to condemn it, but in order that it might be saved through him. That's done. What if hell is off the table? It is. Never did Jesus intend for us to believe in a literal hell where our bodies were tortured. Jesus himself would not have believed that story. What if being on a path toward God is more important than which path it is? To show you how seriously I take this, I'm going to quote from a Sufi poet, Hafiz. He said, "The real love I always keep a secret. All my words are sung outside her window. When she lets me in, I take 1,000 oaths of silence, but then she says, oh, then God says, what the hell, Hafiz? Why not give the whole world my address?" What if heaven is for real? Oh, it is. Like love and courage and compassion and joy are real, not concrete, but real. What if this is the last time we sing King Jesus? It wasn't. If we submit our will to King Jesus, there's little danger we will ever become the Christian army exerting our own will over others. And I saved the big question for last. For today, what if the cross means everything, but not in the way we thought? In Sarah McCammon's new book, The Exvangelicals, Loving, Living, and Leaving the White Evangelical Church, she describes the faith of her childhood, the faith instilled in her by her parents from the time she learned to talk. This is a quote from her book. "Our church had cast off the rituals of older, more established sects for an individualistic, emotional, relational faith. Those rituals did not bring a child into the church. She must choose it for herself and freely believe in salvation through Jesus. She, the child, must recognize that she's a sinner, that like every other human being before her, she was born with a nature that will make sin ineffable, that no sin is too small to deservedly incur God's anger, and that God is pure and holy and righteous and cannot tolerate even a speck of sinfulness. The child must understand, she continues, the child must understand that the only just and appropriate punishment for sin is permanent separation from God in eternal conscious torment, as many pastors reminded us, in the fires of hell, which burn forever but never consume. Well, I know that all of you have not come out of the evangelical church, but if you learned about God in a Lutheran, Episcopal, Catholic church, your understanding likely matched that to some degree. I know mine did. And for those of you who are sitting here thinking, thank God churches don't teach that anymore, then I want you to know you still have time and you don't have to rush. You still have time to make it over to City Reach Church and hear that message for yourself. You know, the one that you've been hearing on the TV for the past week. The screaming, the red and black images, the 9-inch nails, the sacrifice of Jesus, the alternative of hell. You've seen that, right? This message still sells. And it still controls. It still sells, and I pray that you are not buying it. I wish that the story of God's love could be told without the cross. How often I tell it without the cross. And yet I wear the cross around my neck and on my body. As much as my educated, somewhat enlightened, liberal, God-believing, people-loving self would like for it to be otherwise, my faith begins, continues, and lives at the cross. Do I like it? Not really. Do I understand it? Not really. Do I, as often as I can, share the gospel from a Bethlehem perspective? Yes. From a Sermon on the Mount perspective, absolutely. From a love your neighbor as yourself, you bet. My question for you today is, what if the cross means everything but not in the way we thought? There have been times when I've been moved to tears thinking about Jesus' sacrifice on the cross for me. God so loved me that God sent Jesus to die for me. I felt humbled and not guilty exactly, but responsible. But oh, so loved. Because I have been told for my whole life that God sent Jesus to the cross for me instead of me. And I did not question. And the CEOs, I mean the religious establishment, were counting on my not questioning. But as I got older and experienced more, questions were what I had. I thank God that here and in seminary and among my friends and in books, God bless books, my questions were welcome. And though I don't have the answers now any more than I did then, my questions and my searching are blessed. When a child takes those first faltering, failing, falling steps toward you, you do not critique them or rescue them. You cheer them, you applaud them, you tell them, you can do it. And so does God. Over time, I have begun to move toward an understanding of Jesus' work on the cross as the deepest expression of God's love. I do believe that left to our own devices, humans are often sinful. Living in ways that reject the example of Jesus, I admit that I do that. I think Jesus' life, death, and resurrection offer me a way of living at one with God that is based in God's love for me through Jesus Christ and not based on a formula for satisfying the anger of God, the anger you understand that was kindled in the Garden of Eden. Jesus showed us an example of how to love God, neighbor, and selves with our whole hearts, and even in the face of death, his faithfulness to his mission and to God did not waver. I want you to hear that story from the Gospel of Matthew. It's the 28th chapter. After the Sabbath, as the first day of the week was dawning, Mary Magdalene and the other Mary went to see the tomb. And suddenly there was a great earthquake, for an angel of the Lord descending from heaven came and rolled back the stone and sat on it. His appearance was like lightning and his clothing white as snow. For fear of him, the guards shook and became like dead men. But the angel said to the women, "Do not be afraid. For I know that you are looking for Jesus who was crucified. He is not here. He has been raised, as he said. Come, see the place where he lay. Then go quickly and tell his disciples he has been raised from the dead, and indeed he is going ahead of you to Galilee. There you will see him. This is my message for you." So they left the tomb quickly with fear and great joy, and ran to tell his disciples. And suddenly Jesus met them and said, "Greetings." And they came to him, took hold of his feet, and worshiped him. Then Jesus said to them, "Do not be afraid. Go and tell my brothers and sisters to go to Galilee. There they will see me." Now, we have to suspend a lot of belief right here. The disciples have seen Jesus crucified. Some have carried his body to the tomb and left it there and protected the opening with a very large stone. And now here's where the story starts to get sensational. There is an earthquake, a great earthquake, which was caused by an angel descending from above and rolling away the stone in front of the tomb. Now, Mary and the other women on their way to see the tomb were not particularly bothered by the great earthquake, nor were they afraid of the angel who sat upon the stone, even though the angel was so frightening that the armed soldiers guarding the tomb became like dead men. In other words, they were scared to death. And then the angel talks. "Don't be afraid. Jesus was crucified, but he's been raised from the dead. He's going to Galilee." So they ran to tell the disciples. And lo and behold, Jesus met them. And he said, "Greetings." That part gets me. "Greetings." And they evidently recognized him and took hold of his feet and worshiped him. And then Jesus said what the angel had said, "Don't be afraid. Tell my brothers and sisters to go to Galilee. There they will see me." I want to tell you what happens next. Then the 11 disciples went to Galilee, to the mountain where Jesus had told them to go. And when they saw him, they worshiped him. But some doubted. Then Jesus came to them and said, "All authority in heaven and on earth has been given to me. Therefore, go and make disciples of all nations, baptizing them in the name of the Father and of the Son and of the Holy Spirit, and teaching them to obey everything I have commanded you. And I am with you always
to the very end of the age. And that's it. The end. No more chapters in Matthew. Friends, Jesus has been crucified. He has risen. He greets the disciples. He speaks to them. He says, "All authority in heaven and on earth has been given to me. Therefore, go and make disciples and teach them everything that I taught you. And I will be with you even to the end of the age." And that's it. Well, according to Matthew, that's all. To Matthew and to all those who experienced the resurrection and to all those who told the story and protected and preserved it until Matthew could commit it to paper, that is what Jesus said. Hey, don't be afraid. Tell everybody I want to see them. All authority has been given to me. Make disciples. Teach them to do what I have commanded you to do. Love God, love one another, and I will be with you always. That's it. If the message that we are to take from all of this is that we are horrible sinners, and God couldn't stand how awful we were, so God orchestrated that a perfectly lovely, innocent man should be physically sacrificed for us so that God could stand the sight of us. If this was the most important thing, don't you think Jesus would have taken that one last opportunity to tell them so? Do you remember the old days when we had to pay for every minute that we talked on the phone to someone who was outside our area code? Someone long distance? Did your grandmother ever tell your mama to call collect and she would deny the charges just so she would know you'd gotten back home safely, but you didn't have to spend any money on long distance? When you've only got a few seconds, a few words, you use them. You say what is most important, and Jesus did. Don't be afraid. Tell everybody I want to see them. Not, let me take this one last opportunity to make sure you all know how horrible and sinful you are and that I hold you responsible for my death on the cross and don't screw it up again. No. He spoke to us like we were friends, brothers, sisters. Teach everyone what I taught you. To love God, to love one another. I was honored to preach the funeral service for Bryn Hain. You know Bryn. Bryn was a veteran, and her funeral was held at Central Texas State Veterans Cemetery in Killeen. And as I saw all of those gathered there, those friends and family who had loved her, I imagined what it might have been like back when she enlisted. Her parents are gone now, but her brother and sister were there. Her sister carefully received the folded flag and received the Army's gratitude for Bryn's service. I know they were all so proud of her. And I imagine that back when she enlisted, they were proud of her also. And they were probably scared. But they knew that Bryn was doing what she wanted to, what was important to her, in order to help preserve freedom and protect what was good and right. She was willing to go to war. She was willing to die. But she did not wish to. And her parents and her siblings and her friends never wanted her to. They did not send her off to die, though they knew it was a possibility. Do I believe God sent Jesus to earth? Yes. But to live, not to die. To show people what a life lived in love for God and fellow humans could look like. Did God know it was a risk? Yes. Because people are often selfish and small-minded and power-hungry and swayed by crowds. Crucify him. But God took the chance. Because God's love for us is so great. The result? A heartbreaking death on the cross. But before that, a life lived as an example of how to love God, love neighbor, and love ourselves with our whole heart. And after that, a paradigm-shattering, world-saving resurrection that promises human beings that we too can triumph over the ways of the world and live in perfect love and, yes, obedience to God. Jesus showed us how, and he shows us over and over and over again. Amen.